Mr. Campbell, reel one. Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in Ireland at a small town or village called Monastrevan in County Kildare.
And what did your father do for a living?
Well, at that time, he'd come out of the First World War, and he hadn't got a job, and he was given a job by my mother's aunt in a distillery at Monastrevan, which is why we lived there.
Did you go to school in that town?
No, I was very small. We all came over to London in the first instance when I was five.
This was in the mid-20s?
This would be 1925, 26, because one of my early memories of events was the general strike, in which my father was a foreman plate layer on the Piccadilly line.
Where did you have your schooling?
I went, first of all, to a pre-preparatory school called Wagner's in London, and then to a preparatory school in Eastbourne called St. Anthony's, then took the common entrance and went to Cheltenham, where all our family had been, and eventually got entry into St. Andrews University, which I had just gone to when the war began.
What was your reaction when you heard that we were at war with Germany?
I think generally excitement, probably, more than anything else, and a total distraction from studies, in the sense that everybody, all my friends, were going off, and I wanted to go off as quickly as I could. In fact, what happened was that a recruiting person came around looking for volunteers in October of 1939, and I took the King's shilling, as it then was, and enlisted, but I wasn't in fact called until the following year.
What were you studying at St. Andrews?
I was studying for a BSc in chemistry.
Can you tell me how you came to join Popsky's private army?
Well, that is really rather, it's a long story in this sense, in that I had gone, first of all, was called up into the, as a private in the Buffs, went to OCTU in 1940, and went to OCTU in early 41 and was commissioned in 41 into the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. With the Argylls, I went out to Egypt in 1942 to join another battalion, in fact, a Black Watch battalion in the first instance, and then subsequently an Argyll battalion, just after the beginning of the Battle of Alamein. Went through with the battalion until the end of the campaign in Africa. At this point, I was never wounded or affected in any way. I fell into a trench and got streptococci poisoning in my knee, which then, in those days, before the days of penicillin, one was treated with sulfonamide and operations, which put me out of action and, in fact, downgraded me. And I had 3 months' convalescence in North Africa. And at this point, the whole of the 51st Highland Division had gone home. They'd gone through Sicily and gone home. And I was left in a downgraded position as a malaria control officer in the first instance. There was no malaria control at all to be done because the winter was coming on, well, let's say the winter of 1943, and so I was used by the medical department in two ways. I think this is quite an essential part of the story, because what happened was the first thing I was sent to was to look after a conglomeration of Italian hospitals, which had been what they called Ospedale di Campo. And I went there as the Allied presence. They weren't POWs because of the Geneva Convention. And I was the Allied presence to give them permission to the doctors to go into town to buy spaghetti, etc., etc. After a few months of doing that, I had, in fact, learnt quite fluent Italian. And this again affected the whole of my future thinking and indeed of my military career, because having spent that winter, by March, I felt quite ridiculous sitting at my young age and not fighting, and I went to the boss, the medical boss that I had, and said, "Look here, it's ridiculous. I must be upgraded," and he saw no reason why I shouldn't, as a result of which I went to Algiers and went on a draft to go to Italy. On the way there, I met a boy who had been at preparatory school with me, and we both were discussing on the boat what we were going to do, and we both had come to the conclusion that the infantry was not the sort of thing we wanted to do, that it was a hopeless business altogether.
And why was that?
Well, I mean, in the infantry you are so much at the disposal of the senior officers who drive you forward, you have very little opportunity, particularly as a platoon commander, of any initiative of your own. You're part of a major plan, and you are, I think it's been described particularly in the First World War, really rather cannon fodder. And my feelings were that if I was to make a better contribution to the war, it would be in special forces. I had no idea of what or how you got into special forces or how to set about it at all. But we both agreed we'd going to have a try. This is quite a long story, but it's quite an amusing one as well. I was sent to a base depot south of Naples, and by a very curious coincidence, I fell out with the adjutant on the first night that I got there. The reason why was that my kit, in the sort of way that things happen, had gone astray, and the first night in the camp was on bare duckboards with a blanket. The following morning, I got permission from the company commander to go and look for my baggage, which he thought probably had gone to the next door group of units, and indeed I found it there. And I went to the orderly room and said, "Look, I've found my kit there, how can I get it back?" And the sergeant said, "Quite all right, so you go and have lunch in the mess, and I will get a truck." Well, he got a truck and he took it back, and about an hour after he had delivered it, I got a message to report to the adjutant, and I went down, and he started to blow my head off, and he said, "You have deliberately taken the truck that I had ordered to collect ammunition." And I said, "I didn't," and I told him the story, and he wouldn't listen, and he insisted that I came up in front of the colonel. So I came up in front of the colonel, told the story again exactly as I've told you, and the colonel could see that it was absolute nonsense, that I hadn't done anything on my own, and he said, "Don't let it occur again." And so with that, I went back. But the adjutant never forgot me. And the next couple of days, he put me on every sort of course. He sent me on a night patrol course. And then he sent me on a mountain climbing course. But in fact, on the night patrol course, which of course I resented furiously, because I was probably the only person there who'd ever been on a night patrol, having been through the African campaign. And I went on it anyhow, and I did it. And in the afternoon, I went back, after we'd been out all night on the night patrol course, I went back and started to look through my kit. And in the top of a box that I had there, there was a green tin box marked ammunition. I opened it. And inside was a whole collection of booby traps, things that make locks when they're open blow up, fountain pens that blow up, all with German instructions on them. And by the incredible coincidence of life, I thought, well, this is an excellent idea. I will go down and see the training officer, who was also the sort of general affairs officer, if you like, at the same time, and offer him this, because I don't want it. I don't know how it got there. I have no idea. So I went down to see him and found him to be, well, in fact, I already knew because he ran the course for the night patrol. He was red-faced major, probably from the First World War, and he said, "What do you want?" And I went in and I said, "Well, I have a few things here, sir, that might be of interest to you." And he opened the tin and started to play with them. And then he looked up at me quite coyly and said, "I wonder whether you could possibly let me have one or two of these for my museum, which I have. You've seen it, I think." I said, "Yes, well, my idea of coming here, sir, was that you might have all of them." "Oh," he said, "my God, that's absolutely fantastic." He said, "Get this officer a tea and a bun straight away." So he got me a tea and a bun, and he said, "Now, have you any problems?" And I said, "Yes, I would very much like to try to get into special forces." And he said, "Well, 4 o'clock this afternoon," he said, "I'm going down to see the postings officer at the next door battalion, and you come along with me." So I said, "Well, unfortunately, I can't, because I'm in the debriefing for the patrol course which I was on last night." And he said, "Good heavens, no need for you to go on that. I mean, you've undoubtedly done more patrols than I've had hot breakfast." And I said, "Well, thank you very much, sir," and we went down. And he said, walk down to this place, you see, and he said, "Don't bother about the queue," he said, "we'll go straight through." And he spoke to the postings officer, a major, and he said, "Oh, Bill," he said, "I've come to interrupt the proceedings, because," he said, "I have found here one of the most finest young officers I've ever met. Speaks Italian like a native, and would be very interested in posting to special forces. Can you help?" So Bill said, "Well, it's a funny coincidence that you should have said this, because I have had a request this morning by signal to say, could we find anyone for a unit called Number 1 Demolition Squadron? And I will pass your recommendation to them." Well, with that, I left, went back. The next morning, I was on the mountain climbing course. And so we climbed up this mountain and ran down it. And then, the following morning, we were due to start rock climbing with ropes and all that sort of thing, which is the one thing that absolutely frightens me to death. And I prayed that I wouldn't have to do it, or that I could hurt my ankle or do anything of that sort. When suddenly I looked across as we were doing knots, and I saw a chap in a black beret at the side making signals to the training officer. And he went over to him, and he said, and then the training officer said, would you mind, Mr. Campbell, would you come here a second? He said, this chap has come from Popsky's private army, and with instructions to take you back for an interview. And so I said, well, this is most interesting. I went back, packed my bags, went off to a place called Arcella, where I met the second in command of Popsky's, a chap called Jean Carnegie. And to cut a long story short, because it's still quite a long story on its own, I got in.
Had you heard at that time of Popsky's private army?
Well, funnily enough, in talking about with Peter Glass on the boat, he did mention Popsky's private army, but I didn't associate it with Number 1 Demolition Squadron, which was his official War Office name, until the chap actually arrived to pick me up. But there were ridiculous stories going round about their exploits, which I can assure you were grossly exaggerated.
What kind of ridiculous stories?
Oh, about how Popsky had gone behind the lines and had sort of captured thousands of things and lived in Rome and all this type of thing. Totally exaggerated. In fact, his story is quite well known, and he did quite a lot, but the rumours and stories which were spread about it were grossly exaggerated.
And when was this that you first came into contact with the actual unit?
Well, you see, I went up with this chap who was the adjutant of Popsky's. I went up to Achera, and there I had to wait for something like 3 or 4 days before Popsky himself came. And in fact, Popsky, when he saw me, didn't like the look of me at all. And he said, I can't just take him like that, but we've got a trial operation going on. And he said that what this was to be dropped in an area, or dropped off, and then have to come through the mountains, escaping back, so to speak, to your own lines, without being caught. And you had to get back something like 60 miles in 24 hours. And he said, if he gets through that, I'll take him. Well, in fact, I did it. And I don't know how I had the strength to do it, because I was not in good training, but I got myself into good training. And we were, in fact, the group that I was with, which was a wonderful man called Jock Cameron. We were the first in. And even then, Popsky wasn't keen, but Jean Canry, with whom I'd become very good friends and have been ever since until he died last year, he said, you can't make a pledge, you can't make a promise and then not stick to it. So I was taken on, and was taken on, in fact, to replace the man who'd picked me up, the adjutant.
Why do you think Popsky hadn't liked the look of you at first?
He never told me that he didn't like me. He was the most extraordinary man I've ever met. Very difficult to understand, as you probably, if you've ever read about him, he was a Russian blood completely, although a Belgian national. He was totally different to anybody else, and he didn't speak a great deal. He wasn't a person who talked a lot. So he never said to me, I don't like you. He just said, you'll have to do this, and then he said, all right, I'll take you on. He wrote in his book that I looked, that I had long hair and was in Highland trews, and he didn't think I was the type at all.
Did you have long hair?
I don't remember. I didn't think it was particularly long.
When you say he was a difficult man to understand, do you mean because he spoke so little or because he spoke with a thick accent?
Oh, no. He was totally fluent. He'd been to Cambridge. He was educated in England, and he was totally fluent in French. He'd been in the French army in the First World War. And then, as I mentioned before, he took a degree at Cambridge. And although he had a degree of accent, quite different to anything else, not a strong one, but a noticeable one, quite different to anyone else, he was, by and large, very strange looking. He looked both Slav and indeed Jewish, which made him capable of passing as an Arab behind the enemy lines in Africa, and put on a galabeer, and he looked like an Arab. But he was a very silent sort of person, unless he was animated. If he was happy and things were going well, then he would become animated and was extremely funny. He was wonderful company, but everybody was terrified of him, generally speaking, and he used to have black rages, in which his face went absolutely black, and he probably would say nothing for quite a long time. I came across this once or twice. But he certainly wouldn't have said to me, he wouldn't have been chatty with me as a new recruit, and he didn't say a lot to me, even in the sort of better days, except when we were perhaps eating out together in a restaurant or something, then we would chat about everything all over the place. He was likeable, but he was totally different. There was nobody like him at all that I've ever met.
Was he a Jew?
Yes, he was. He wasn't a practicing Jew, and probably if you'd asked him, he would have said, well, I don't know. I don't know whether he would have been either anti-Jewish or was ashamed of it. He never mentioned it, but it was the plain truth was that if you look at his face, you will see the Semitic influence. And it was the history of it was that he had been not an émigré, or his parents had not been émigrés from Russia under the Soviets. He had been driven out in a pogrom against the Jews by the Tsars before the First World War in 1905.
And you found this test quite difficult, did you?
Yes, I did, but I, in fact, my memory of it, when you consider that it's something like, what was it, it's nearly 50 years ago, my memory of it was not one of despair at all. It's quite enjoyable.
And this was 43 that you did the test?
44, because March 44 that we sailed to Italy.
And which month did you do the test?
Well, it would have probably been the end of March, I should think. If I remember rightly, we sailed over, and within inside of a week, I was with PPA, then waited for about 10 days, and then the test started almost immediately after that.
What were your initial impressions of the PPA as a unit?
It's very difficult to answer that question. I was, of course, excited by it. I was delighted to be in it. I found the people in it were interesting because a very large proportion of them had come from other units who had already got quite a reputation, not as great as they have had since when their whole story had been written up, but the Long Range Desert Group was something one had known about, and the SAS had already made a name for itself, although, as I said, the history of them had not been written at the time, and perhaps the descriptions of their operations were more lurid than they really were in real life. But most of the people had had some experience, either in SAS or LRDG, and were very amusing people. They dropped ranks to come into PPA, and I found them very entertaining. And the second thing, of course, which was strange to me, having been in the infantry, where there was a strict hierarchy and a discipline, in PPA there was a sort of rule. It was a self-imposed rule that you called everybody by their first name. That's to say, the majority of my patrol, which I took over quite shortly after coming in, because the other chaplain was kicked out, they called me by my first name and I called them by theirs. And the command structure was purely based on personality and respect. If a new chap came into the patrol and started to call me John, then he would get blasted by everyone else and said that he wasn't going to be allowed to do that until he'd made his way himself and established himself as one of them. So that it was a completely new experience to be in such a unit. I can't really go further than that.
How did they fit you into the unit to start off with?
Well, I came in as rather fortunately, because the man who came to pick me up was in fact under notice of sacking. I think I should, for the record, tell you what in fact happened when he came to pick me up, because he had himself been recruited as having been adjutant of another battalion group in the depot, and he had come in as adjutant to PPA, proved to be a complete useless, utterly useless, and was being sent back, and I was to become his replacement. When he came to collect me, he spoke to this adjutant who had had, with whom I'd had the set to about allegedly pinching his truck on purpose, and this adjutant gave him a colossally bad picture of me, saying I was totally useless and that I went round, I was undisciplined and hopeless. If he'd been anybody else but this man who'd come to pick me up, he no doubt would have gone away without picking me up at all. But since he was under instructions and would never have breached them, he did pick me up and take me there. And soon, almost immediately after I had been accepted, he was sacked and I came in as adjutant. I didn't particularly like this because the adjutant sat with the headquarters and didn't have any fighting role at all. But fortunately, as I said, another chap shot himself in the knee in S Patrol of Popsky's, and I was appointed to S Patrol, the second commander of S Patrol, with which I remained until the end of the Italian campaign.
Why was it called S Patrol?
It was called S Patrol because the first commander of it was a South African. No other reason.
And what role were they performing when you joined them?
We were doing the least productive role that we ever did, in that what we were doing was to going up to the front, which was not a dug-in front like Casino at the time, and driving very, very quietly in our jeeps from hidden positions, as far hidden by cover, and then opening fire, as you realize, or perhaps you do know from the historical point of view, we had two machine guns, one 5.0 and another one 303 machine guns, which came from aircraft. So we could deliver the most incredible amount of firepower onto a target in a very, very quick time, with incendiary and armor-piercing, etc., etc. So what we could do was to go up, fire like mad on a target where we could see enemy in various haystacks and positions on the sort of somewhat loose front line, and then disappear before they could start locating us to put shell fire or mortar fire onto us. They did try, but we were able to move out, and only when we put up dust clouds by going down the tracks did they ever get anywhere near us. I think the idea of it was, we were never actually told, was to give the Germans an idea that there was a great deal more there than there actually was. We did this twice in our history, one quite a lot later in the south of Ravenna. But it wasn't tremendously exciting, or it seemed to me very productive, because we never knew whether we'd created casualties or not. I mean, they were too far away. It was really a morale exercise more than anything else.